Today, the end of America's influence in Syria after Trump's shocked decision to withdraw US troops. And Amelia Gentleman on the EU citizens struggling to confirm their post-Brexit immigration status.
Well, Sunday evening in Qamishli in northeastern Syria, a news flash had come through which said that the Syrian regime was returning to two towns in northern Syria, Manbij and Kobani. The internet was cut, the streets of Qamishli were rapidly emptying, and it dawned on us pretty suddenly with a feeling of dread really washing through ourselves and also our hosts. We no longer controlled our environment. There were so many variables. Potentially the Syrian regime could be coming for us, potentially we couldn't be able to escape. It was the first time I'd felt the effects of a vacuum in real time. This was the moment that power was actually changing hands.
The power was shifting from the Kurds to Moscow-backed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, allowing him to take back this part of Syria that he had lost. But it was more than that. This was also power shifting on a global scale. As America's role in Syria ends, a new era of Russian dominance in the Middle East begins. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the fallout from the withdrawal of US troops in Syria. This story begins in a mountainous region of the Middle East with the Kurdish people. The Kurds don't have a country, but are instead splintered across four: Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. They've had a presence in northeastern Syria for a long time, but under the regime of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad and then his son Bashar, they had little control. But when the Syrian civil war began, this changed. In 2012, Bashar al-Assad decided to give concessions to the Kurds and control over their affairs in the region. In exchange, they promised some political support and to not attack Damascus. It was an uncomfortable coexistence, but for a time, it worked.
Yeah, 2014 was a seminal moment in the modern history of the Kurds.
Martin Chulov reports on the Middle East for The Guardian and has just returned from northeastern Syria.
ISIS, the Islamic State terror group, had attacked the town of Kobani in the north of the country. It's a very Kurdish town. And they'd put a lot of effort into it. They'd sent as many men as they could, and the Kurds were defending, but they could not defend the town against the overwhelming numbers that were heading their way. So the US Air Force stepped in and partnered with them, and the bombing campaign that the Americans launched was successful in driving ISIS back. And from then, the Americans decided to partner on the ground with Kurdish forces in northeastern Syria, who were used as effectively as ground forces to combat the Islamic State in Syria. We reached a point in March this year where the war against them had denied them all access to any land that they'd held. Thousands of ISIS members and those who were traveling with them emerged from tunnels and dungeons and foxholes in the desert. And they were taken to detention centres, and the Kurds, who had fought them so valiantly for the last 4 years, ended up being jailers of overwhelming numbers of people. Upwards of 90,000 ISIS members or family members ended up in detention centres in northeastern Syria.
And you've been covering this conflict between the Kurds and Islamic State on the ground over the years. How much of a toll have you seen it take on them? What price have they paid?
Well, 11,000 casualties straight up front, that is battle dead. Upwards of 50,000 wounded. I mean, a significant toll being taken on the psyche of the people. This is a traumatized society who have been fighting for decades, whether it be with the Turks, whether it be with the Syrian regime, or a formidable insurgency on the ground. So there is a lot of fatigue, a lot of war fatigue, as there would be after such a draining effort. Quite simply, the Islamic State would not have been defeated in Syria were it not for the Kurds.
So you had this alliance between the US and the Kurds, which seemed to be strengthening over time. But just across the border, Turkey was watching on with increasing alarm. And that's because they see the Kurds in Syria as an extension of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, who for the last few decades have fought for autonomy in Turkey and are considered a terrorist organisation by the US and the UK. How did Turkey view what was going on in northeastern Syria?
To Turkey, the US partnership with the Kurds in 2015 had formed a pact with Turkey's most lethal foe. So Turkey would say that it had a cast iron right to oppose what was taking place, which was consolidating its most significant enemy just across its border. In Turkey's mind, the US partnering with an enemy of a NATO partner was the wrong thing to do. And an accommodation was reached in which the Turks had a level of understanding that during the fight against ISIS, they would more or less look the other way. But there was always going to come a day where this relationship was no longer seen as tenable to Turkey, and they were expecting Washington to make a choice between themselves or the Kurds. And that's exactly what Donald Trump has done.
Turkish military offensive into northern Syria appears imminent after the US announced it is moving its forces out of the region, effectively abandoning its longtime allies, the Kurds. The decision to withdraw US forces comes after a phone conversation between US President Donald Trump and his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkey.
Martin, what was the fallout from Trump's announcement last week?
History will record that the green light to President Erdogan was given by a consent of the President of the United States. I mean, the vacuum that created was almost instantaneous. It was something that the Turkish president had used to license his ambitions, which were to take a swathe of northern Syria, roughly 60 kilometers wide and 30 kilometers deep, in which he was planning to relocate Syrians who had been exiled in Istanbul or in other parts of Turkey throughout the Syrian civil war. He wanted to use them as a buffer between the Kurds and the Turks to ensure that he emerged with something out of this war, and his strategic goal was to change the colour of the border.
What did you do, Martin, when you heard about Trump's decision to withdraw US forces?
Well, I was in Beirut at the time, and it was obvious immediately what this would mean, and that is the Turks would feel licensed to launch their operation, and that there would very likely be a war. So to me, it was obvious we needed to get to Erbil first, which is in northern Iraq, and then cross the border into Syria and to bear witness to what was about to take place. It wasn't, it must be said, a scene of panic. It was almost a sense of resignation. Now, these are people who had been through war and hardship before, and this was another stanza, an important one, but another stanza nonetheless. There were refugees heading out in overladen lorries, bustled in the back like cattle with all their belongings. In a couple of cases, there were girls carrying their pets.
I mean, clearly people had just sort of grabbed everything that they could. Was there a feeling amongst them of anger?
Yeah, some of those who were waiting to be evacuated were certainly very angry, and they were directing their anger towards anyone who wasn't from there, including us. Another couple of gentlemen were raging against Erdogan, and some were also raging against Donald Trump. Now, it's totally reasonable that those who were being forced to abandon their homes for exile inside their own country should be angry about what had taken place, particularly in those circumstances.
And then after a tense couple of days, the Turkish attacks began. What have you seen on the ground, Martin? How has this conflict played out?
We made our way to the edge of the conflict zone. It was like any war zone, really, where modern heavy weapons being dropped from fast jets cause significant damage.
This woman's son has just been killed by the Turks. She lost two other sons in the fight against Islamic State. The dead man was a parent himself, This is his son. We're at the Kurdish Field Hospital closest to the front line. Here, doctors and nurses patch up the injured as best they can before they are moved to better and safer medical centres.
The Turks have a very powerful military, and the Kurds, who are better known for fighting in the mountains, found the terrain, which was largely flat and urban, very difficult to defend. They would head to the battlefront on motorbikes or in white vans. A couple of Kurdish Special Forces officers would be hiding their weapons under a blanket, and they'd hope that the Turkish drones above wouldn't see them. They did, though, and the Turks were successful in their attacks.
Did you speak to people who have lost loved ones in the last week?
Last Friday, we spent half a day outside a hospital morgue, and there were families there who were claiming their loved ones who were inside the morgue who had been killed in the fighting. We didn't have a lot to do with them. They were obviously very grief-stricken. We just spent time sitting with them. There was one mother. She was Kurdish from Ras Al-Ain. Her husband was an Arab, and their son was lying on the floor of the morgue, having been shot in the head that morning outside of their house. They said they didn't know who'd done the shooting, and it didn't really care that their son was a martyr. The mother sat in the ground, gently nodding from side to side and singing songs to her dead son as her other son held her hand. One of the morgue workers walked out, and she put a light veil on top of the mother's head and caressed her for a few minutes and just spoke to her in Kurdish, just saying that how noble her son was and how good a mother she had been. I just think it said so much about the essence of a broken society, and yet amongst it, there are glimmers of humanity which really do resonate.
Amidst all of this carnage, some US troops were still in the region, trapped by the fighting. They're watching this all unfold around them. How do you think they've been feeling about this decision?
We haven't had any direct access to the US troops here, but there certainly has been a lot of indication that many of those who are leaving in such circumstances are doing so with a sense of shame and of regret. Special Forces for the US in northeast of Syria sent a tweet, which was simply hashtag SDF, SDF being the Syrian Democratic Forces, the very organization that the US partnered with and raised. Now, that was quite obviously an act of defiance. Retreating in such a precipitous way is seen by many of them as a humiliation, as is betraying, and I use that word avowedly, the very people who had won this war for them.
And in the absence of these American troops, the Kurds over the past few days have had to stay in control of this territory, guard IS captives where they can, and fight the Turkish army with its huge air force. Did it become increasingly clear that the Kurds were in an unwinnable position at the end of last week?
Yeah, it was certainly clear by the end of last week, and even at the beginning of the week, that the Kurds could not hold ground against a modern military with an air force that could dominate the skies. So the only option they had seemed to be a political one.
This morning, Syrian troops lost no time advancing north. Their cheers are for President Assad, who has now won most of his country back after around 500,000 dead and over 8 years of war. His return here has been made possible after Syrian Kurds cut a deal with Damascus and American troops began to withdraw.
In the town of Hasaka, state TV showed people celebrating the agreement between the regime and the Kurdish authority. In private, others wept in fury and despair.
That political option, the last resort for the Kurds, was a deal with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces. What is this deal and how does it work?
The essence of the deal is that after 7 years of semi-autonomy, the Kurds will hand over administration of the region to the Syrian military. So the Syrians will return in numbers, and they've already started doing so. They will take control of civilian affairs and of military affairs. They will take control of the border crossing points with Turkey and with Iraq. The SDF, the force that the Americans raised of Kurds, will be subsumed into the Syrian military, known as the 5th Battalion. So they will be directionally under the control of Syrian generals. This doesn't leave the Kurds of the region with too much room to move. They will be not equal partners with the Syrian regime. They will be potentially allowed some freedoms, but not many. And it very much is a reversal of fortunes for them after 7 years of more or less being in control of their own destiny.
How did this deal come about?
I spoke with a very senior Kurdish official who is responsible for political strategy and military strategy in the region. Her name was Ashan Mizgin Ahmed. She said to me that they simply had no option. Ashan Mizgin Ahmed was very strong in her understanding that even though the Syrian regime were the ones who would be coming back to the region, that the Russians would be calling the shots. I mean, they were dealing directly with the Russians. They were negotiating with them, not the regime themselves. The messages were being filtered from Damascus to the Russians and onwards and backwards. So going forward, it's very obvious to the Kurdish administration that Russia is the dominant power in this region, with the Syrian regime being in some ways their proxy.
What happened on the ground after this deal was struck? How did people respond?
Well, the initial hours after the deal were filled with an emptiness, a resignation, and people just retreated to their houses. Qamishli and other parts of the northeast were completely empty. Politically, culturally, and even socially, I think the Kurds are feeling a deep sense of abandonment and loss at the moment. They don't understand how a global power that had given their word could do this to them.
What is going on now on the ground, Martin, since this deal was struck? Could this open up a battle between Syrian forces, backed by Russia, and Turkish forces?
I don't see a risk of a battle between the Syrian military and the Turks. I think the Turks are happy with the concessions that they've received. They will take control of the land that they've seized from the northeast, and they will consolidate a presence there with their broader goals of a demographic shift bearing out in the coming months and years. They will also be happy with the Syrian regime along their border, so there is effectively a buffer between them and the Kurds now. So the regime will understand that the Turks have got more or less what they wanted. And the regime have too, which is effective control of the northeast. There'll be lots of saber rattling. There'll be posturing over various parts of the region in order to save face. But I think the risks of a clash between either side are very low.
The risk of a conflict between Turkey and Syria might be low, but there are other dangers, aren't there? Northeastern Syria is also where thousands of Islamic State fighters and their families are trapped in camps guarded by the Kurds.
A Turkish shell slams into an ISIS prison compound. Moments later, ISIS prisoners are seen making a break for it.
Over the weekend, it was reported that at least 750 ISIS affiliates had escaped from one camp as a result of the fighting. Is there any chance of an Islamic State resurgence now?
If the Islamic State are able to break out, then I don't think that they would regroup in a straight-up conventional military sense. They would revert to the insurgency, which they know how to fight very well. But they would be doing so this time on both sides of the Iraqi border. In Iraq, we are seeing an uptick in parts of the country of insurgent attacks. And in Syria, I think there'd be a very, very real risk of that happening, particularly if the ground that they used to hold is no longer effectively secured by Kurdish forces or the Syrian military if they step into those areas. So the real risk is them being able to lay low, use the time that they spent in prison to reorganize, to plot, and to get out, and then to carry out those plots. That's certainly what happened during large-scale prison breakouts in Iraq. It was one of the reasons that led to the rise of ISIS in the very first place. The US detention camps played a very significant role there. And I think there is a potential for the Syrian detention camps to be the US camps writ large. So this is something which really does need to be watched in very urgent terms in coming months.
The US isn't the only Western nation deeply involved in this part of Syria. Britain and France have special forces in the region too, and many Islamic State fighters in the camps are from Europe. What should the response from these countries be?
There are large numbers of British and French citizens, as there are citizens from other European countries still in detention here. And I really do think there is an obligation to step up and do something about that very, very quickly to avoid the potential for a breakout. I think getting these people back to Europe to face justice in their own countries, regardless of the legal difficulties in doing so, must be a first step. Or else what has this last 7 years been all about if we're back to where we started?
It's really incredible to think what has happened in this region in just over a week. What are the wider geopolitical implications of all of this?
Well, I think they're very significant. And I think 16 years after the US invasion of Iraq, the last US offensive fighting troops have left the region. They leave the region after spending hundreds of billions of dollars in wars that have done little to advance the causes that they were purported to, individual liberties, freedoms, and other things. And the region itself is very quickly regressing back to an era of tyrants, of subjects instead of citizens, and of new superpowers stepping into the vacuum. It's always been a part of the world where power and authority and influence has been bitterly contested. And as the US leaves, it is obvious now to many observers that the Russians are saying, we are the new power in the region. A day after brokering that deal between the Syrians and the Syrian regime and the Kurds, Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in Riyadh for a state visit. Now, this was not coincidental.
It seems like a moment of opportunity for Russia. President Vladimir Putin's trip to the Saudi capital Riyadh as tensions with main regional rival Iran grow.
It's obvious that that new partnerships are being formed, new alliances are being formed, that the US may even begin to be doubted globally as a superpower these days. It certainly doesn't appear to have the interest in leading any sort of a global order. I think there's no question that this marks a very significant moment in the modern history of the region. It is beyond a simple handover of power in eastern Syria. What this represents is a change in the balance of power across the entire Middle East. This is the end of the post-Saddam US presence in the region. And they may well look back and say, what have we achieved in our 16 years on the ground here? At this point, a week after Donald Trump's decision, I think the answer would be not much at all.
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You can read more of Martin's reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, the millions of EU citizens applying for settled and pre-settled status. Now, as part of the government's Brexit preparations, EU citizens living in the UK are being sorted into two new immigration categories. Settled status for those who have lived in the UK for over 5 years, and pre-settled status for those who arrived after that. The Home Office have said that the application should only take 15 minutes, but according to The Guardian's Amelia Gentleman, who broke the Windrush immigration scandal last year, things are not that simple.
The way that it works is there's an app which is currently only working on Android phones. And what you do is you use your Android phone to scan your passport or your ID document, and then instant checks are made with the tax authorities to see whether they can confirm immediately that you've been living in the UK for 5 years. I spent several weeks this year following somebody called Doris Ratnam, who's been in the UK since 1968 when she arrived as an au pair. Her application should have been absolutely simple. And in a way, nothing went wrong catastrophically with her case. But it was very, very complicated for her. The scanning system didn't work. When she went to try and get help from the local council, they couldn't help her. It took a lot of her time and it left her feeling very unhappy and angry because she said that she was being made to feel like a foreigner in Britain, which is a country that she's lived in for half a century. There have been a lot of stories about people who've lived here for 10 years, for 15 years, who've gone through the application process and ended up with this pre-settled status. It's the one area that campaigners are very concerned about because the proportion of people getting the pre-settled status has been rising month on month. The reason why people are concerned about it is because there's a belief that if you look at the migration patterns, actually a much larger proportion of EU nationals are thought to have arrived longer ago. So it doesn't quite tally with what lawyers were expecting in terms of the proportions. The Home Office has done a lot of work to try and learn the lessons of Windrush. And in a way, the application process is much, much simpler than the process which Windrush generation people had to go through. The problem is that because the numbers are so huge, we're talking about 3.4, 3.5 million EU nationals living in the UK, even if the government has a 95% success rate with this scheme, that still leaves over 100,000 people who could potentially be left out, who perhaps won't have applied. Campaigners are particularly worried about older people, people who are vulnerable, women who perhaps haven't worked all their lives, so have less documentation, fewer tax records. So the scale of the project is so enormous that it could go incredibly well and yet still have very, very many people left out. And I think that that's the single thing that people are most concerned about.
That was Amelia Gentleman. My thanks to her and Martin Chulov. Today's episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.